This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to be talking about our summer reading list, and not just any books. We're going to be talking science fiction, so you want to get ready for that. But first, stem cells, those raw building blocks of our body that can form any type of cell. They have opened up an exciting area for personalized medicine. You've probably heard of all sorts of potential treatments, from quick fixes for athletes to repairment of ligaments or cartilage to growing new teeth or corneas. And one of the first treatments was to use stem cells formed into the blood to treat cancer. And that therapy started in the 1960s and has become common practice since then. So how have these blood-forming stem cell therapies progressed in 50 years? And what might we see in the next half century? Irv Wiseman is the director of the Institute of Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine, also the Ludwig Center for Cancer Stem Cell Research at Stanford University, a longtime researcher in stem cell research. Irv, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You've researched blood-forming stem cells in cancer therapy since the 1970s. How far have we come? Are we still talking about bone marrow transplants or a lot of different stuff?
Well, we are talking about what was then bone marrow transplants, but the scientists in the 80s and 90s found a way to tease out those earliest cells that make blood from the bone marrow into the blood. That's called mobilization. And I formed a company called Systemics in 1988, where we found that we could purify from mobilized blood pure blood-forming stem cells with no other cells that contaminate it. That became important because one of the trials that was going on in the 90s was to treat women with widespread breast cancer. So it had gone beyond the breast, beyond the lymph node, to the bones, the lung, the liver, and so on. So they had no hope of any local therapy to save them. But you could give high-dose chemotherapy, and the more chemotherapy you gave, the more cancer cells in the body you killed. When we looked at the mobilized blood from those women, we saw that over half of the samples had breast cancer cells in it. And it was true the same whether it was lymphoma patients and lymphoma mobilized blood, myeloma patients, myeloma cancer cells in the blood. But when we purified the blood-forming stem cell from the mobilized blood for the first time on Earth, we could give back to those women cancer-free stem cells to regenerate their blood-forming system at doses of chemotherapy that, without return of cells, would kill them. That was done at a trial at Stanford University, and my company was bought by a large company later for many reasons that we can discuss that in a minute. But they shut it all down in 2000. So 5 years ago, Judy Shizuru, one of the therapeutic bone marrow transplanters at Stanford, and Antonio Muller and I went back, and we found out that one-third of the women who got our cancer-free stem cells were alive apparently without disease. But at that time point, only 7% of the women who were rescued with full mobilized blood, cancer-contaminated blood, were alive. So that was one-third versus 7%. And I, of course, immediately notified that large company, but they remained silent.
They didn't want to go into this research? Or what, there's no money to be made in this sort of thing?
It's always a speculation why they decided not, but they told me it was a business decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to get back all of the materials and antibodies eventually. I had to give away any financial gain I had to other people, so I couldn't make a profit, and we have it at Stanford. And beginning this summer, we are opening up pure stem cell transplants. Now, the first transplants, in fact, won't be for the breast cancer patients. We have to work that up. But the blood-forming system is sometimes genetically gone wrong, like in sickle cell anemia or thalassemia or juvenile diabetes. And we wanted to be able to give back purified blood-forming stem cells from a donor, a related donor, who didn't have that disease, so that we could replace the defective blood system with one that's not defective. Now, we are actually going to approach children that have the bubble boy disease. They have no adult immune system. And we will transplant them with pure blood-forming stem cells, either from their mother or from a sibling. Normally, when you do a donor-to-host transplant with full mobilized blood, there are cells in the blood called T cells, whose normal job is to kill cancer cells, to kill invading cells, to kill cancer cells, and so on. And when they are given from a donor to a host, the ones that would have rejected the recipient's skin will go to the skin and reject it. The ones that would have rejected the lung will go to the lungs and reject it. In a word, they have a multi-system immune reaction of the donor or the graft against the host. That happens in every patient now who gets a donor transplant. So our field hasn't advanced that much. They've advanced to try to ameliorate that with immunosuppressive drugs that you often take for life.
Mm-hmm.
But with cancer-free and T-cell-free stem cells, we found not only would they engraft in all the model systems, but there was no graft versus host disease. And because the blood-forming system, let's say from me, put into you, could regenerate my blood-forming system in you, we found that you could receive from me a skin graft or a heart graft or an insulin-producing islet graft without any more immunosuppression. The key is to get my blood-forming system to grow up in you. So with pure stem cells, we showed in animal model after animal model that we could have a platform for regenerative medicine. If you needed a lung, you would get a stem cell from the lung donor, a blood-forming stem cell, and the lung itself, and eventually a lung stem cell.
Right.
So this is the basis for regenerative medicine, and our clinical trial to start at Stanford this summer for those children with the bubble boy disease will have, instead of chemotherapy to prepare them, because it is dangerous, high-dose chemotherapy, we have substituted antibodies that will remove their own defective stem cells so the new ones can come in.
Irv, let me move on because I only have a few more minutes. I want to ask you about CRISPR. You know what CRISPR is, and it's been in the news lately. And it's
right.
been said that to be a big game changer for the field of gene editing, you know that, do stem cells need a CRISPR, some kind of technology that will advance the field?
Sure. So one way would to treat this child with severe combined immunodeficiency would be use the CRISPR enzymes to remove the defective gene and also to replace it with a healthy gene so they could get their own blood-forming stem cells. Now, we don't care whether it's a donor T-cell-free stem cell or their own stem cell genetically modified. We just want to see the kids get cured.
Yeah. Another promise. I'm sorry, I want to ask, move on. There's another promising use for stem cells, possibly in diabetes. Is it possible to use it to cure diabetes?
That's what I was going to say. So Judy Shizuru and I showed years ago in the animals that have the same genetic type of type 1 diabetes that blood-forming stem cells from a donor that is not going to get diabetes prevents the immune system from killing the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. If they already had lost their insulin-producing cells, we have to co-transplant blood-forming stem cells and insulin-producing cells, or the stem cells that give rise to insulin-producing cells, all of which we would get from either embryonic stem cells eventually, or that induced pluripotent cells where you reprogram an adult cell back to that young form. And of course, it would be the same whether we were doing diabetes or if we wanted to treat multiple sclerosis with blood-forming stem cells and brain-forming stem cells, or even spinal cord injury, blood-forming stem cells from the donor and brain-forming stem cells from the same donor.
So it seems like these blood-forming stem cells hold the key to a lot of, potentially to a lot of different diseases or maladies.
I think it's the platform. It's the one big leap we need. And so we need to be able to do that now from adult donors. But 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we want to have those what's called pluripotent or embryonic-like or embryonic stem cells to turn them into blood-forming stem cells, turn them into the other cell type we want, and then co-transplant them from the same donor.
Mm-hmm. And how far away do you think we are from that day?
We're starting the first part right now, and thanks to the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, Prop 71, we are able to carry out this next trial with purified stem cells. And we are working right now on the project, many labs are, to get every tissue-specific stem cell from these pluripotent stem cell lines.
And the stem cells are able to actually knock out the autoimmune disease that might bring back, let's say, diabetes?
Yes. But the way they do it is that you use antibodies to clear out the autoimmune cells, so we'll use anti-T-cell antibodies and anti-stem cell antibodies, and then when the new stem cells come in, they make new T-cells in your body, and they eliminate all of the autoimmune T-cells against yourself and against me as the donor.
Wow. That's because yeah. I know people have been working on this to sort of relieve the symptoms, but they always said that the disease, the autoimmunity, is just going to come back and start it again, but you found something new here.
Right. This, in animal models, works for type 1 diabetes, lupus, and a whole set of others that we've explored. So we have high hopes that we'll be able to overcome the current barriers, which are mainly financial and company-type barriers, to take a discovery from the laboratory in an academic institution, do the first proof of principle in a clinical trial at that same institution with the same investigators, and then be able to release it to the public for some commercial entity.
Good luck to you, Irv. Irv Weissman, director of the Institute of Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine. He's out there at Stanford. After the break, we want to hear from you sci-fi geeks. 844-724-8255. What are your favorite sci-fi books for summer reading? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've been talking about radical ideas and ideas in using the body's cells and using it to cure. But what if you could use parts of your body to actually choose? I have an idea, for example. Here's the idea. What if you could take your skin cells and turn them into viable human cells, human eggs, you know, kinds that women carry around their ovaries? Scientists have already done that procedure in mice, turning skin cells into eggs and into sperm. And guess what? They raised baby mice from those stem cell-derived cells. So how long before that's the norm for human reproduction? Given the rate of technological advancements, well, my guess wagers it's going to be just 20 to 40 years from now. He writes about the brave new world of human reproduction in his new book, The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. And being a lawyer and an ethicist, he raises a lot of dicey questions for that future world, too. Like, if you could choose to spare your child a debilitating genetic disease by screening, let's say, 100 test tube embryos first, would you do that? What if you also had the option to choose other traits, like hair color versus musical ability, and trade off something else? And more importantly, who has access to the technology and who doesn't? Who, you have to be a rich person? Will everybody have access to this? What do you think? A dangerous idea, natural progression, stuff you'd like to be part of? Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Hank Greeley is the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction, professor of law who teaches law and genetics at Stanford University. Welcome back to Science Friday, Hank.
Thanks very much, Ira.
When you say the end of sex, you're just not talking about sex.
Yeah, I think that we will continue to have whatever we and Bill Clinton define as sex enthusiastically for a long time, but I don't think we're going to use it to make babies nearly as often. My guess is that in 20 to 40 years, most people in countries with good health systems will conceive their babies in clinics so they can do whole genome sequencing on about 100 embryos and pick the embryo they like best.
So you would be able to take the skin cells from anybody and turn them into embryos and sperm?
That turn them into eggs and sperm.
I'm sorry, and eggs and sperm. Yeah.
To make embryos. Yeah.
Wow.
I think that's likely to happen. This process of induced pluripotent stem cells, for which Shimya Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize in almost record time, is so exciting, and so much money and effort is going into it. It's not going into it for reproductive purposes. It's going into it for nerve cells and pancreas cells and other cells for medical purposes. But as we learn more about deriving specific cell types from these iPSCs, these induced pluripotent stem cells, we're going to make eggs and sperm. And the first steps have already been taken toward that in humans in terms of making primordial the primordial cells that ultimately become eggs and sperm. No one has tried to make eggs and sperm for humans from these yet, as far as I know, but I think that's just a matter of time.
So then you would wind up with, a few dozen embryos from these cells from your skin, and you would choose, you choose which embryos you'd want to keep?
Yeah, I think so, although an interesting point about making eggs this way, The issue is mainly eliminating egg harvest, which is expensive, unpleasant, and risky. Sperm harvest has not been as big a problem. But when you do egg harvest for IVF, you get somewhere between 0 and 25 eggs, usually about 10 or 12. When you make them from skin cells, how many eggs do you get? How many do you want? You could make hundreds, thousands, potentially millions. I think, you know, roughly 100 embryos. Do whole genome sequencing on each of those embryos, and then the prospective parents have the real hard time of trying to weigh all the pluses and minuses in those 100 embryos.
So each of those 100 embryos would have a combination of the genes from the parents with different traits and possibility of diseases, and you would, through analyzing the genetics of those, be able to give them a choice of what, you know, of good news and bad news.
Right. I think parents would be asked, what do you want to know? We can tell you about the really nasty early genetic diseases that affect 1 to 2% of births. We can tell you about risk factors for later diseases like breast cancer, colon cancer, Alzheimer's disease. We can tell you about hair color, skin color, nose shape, early white hair, things like that. We can tell you a little bit about behaviors, you know, maybe 12% chance of being in the top 10% in math ability. And the last and easiest category, we can tell you boy or girl. What do you want to know? We'll tell you, and then you tell us which embryos you want to move into a womb to try to make a baby.
This also means that gay or lesbian couples could have a baby with their own genetic material without looking for donor egg or sperm, doesn't it?
Yeah, that takes one more step, but I think it's a plausible one, and not just me. Other people I've talked to in the field think it's a plausible one, to take skin cells from a man and turn them into eggs, and skin cells from a woman and turn them into sperm, or at least things that are good enough to be used as sperm. They don't have to be fully functional, because we can take sperm and inject them directly into the egg. You don't necessarily have to make sperm that can swim as far as they do the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
The trickiest part would be making sperm from women that could give rise to boys. You'd have to add a Y chromosome. 20 to 40 years from now, I think that's plausible, but we'll have to wait and see.
Well, what would be the difference between what you're suggesting and so-called designer babies?
Yeah, so what I'm talking about is really embryo selection. Two people get together, they make embryos. The embryos can only have whatever those two people bring to the plate. So if they're both blue-eyed, they're not going to get a brown-eyed baby. If they're both blood type O, they're not going to get a blood type A baby. With designer embryos, you could, in theory, change the genes, change the genetic variation, so that two people who were blood type O could have a blood type A baby. When I started writing this book, I dismissed that as decades away. CRISPR-Cas9 caused me to rewrite a significant chunk of the book, because I now think it's closer than I had expected, but it adds additional risks, and I think it's still a decade or two farther away than what I call easy PGD.
You know, the cynic part of me always thinks of things that could happen, and when I was reading about this, I said, what's to prevent me from getting some skin cells from a celebrity, you know, movie stars? taking them, you know, they drink out a cup of coffee or water or something like that, and you take the cup, or you get just happen to shake hands and scrub off some skin cells with it and take it back, and then now I'm going to have their baby. You know, I can turn that into an egg.
So you'll be pleased to know that you're not the only cynical person out there. This issue occurred to me, and I talk about it some. I think we will need laws against inadvertent parenthood. You know, right now you'd have to steal somebody's eggs or sperm, and that's tricky. But stealing cells from somebody, any discarded Coke can is going to have some cells on it. But that's just, you know, the whole issue of being able to make gametes from cells is going to throw out some things that will be surprising. Some I'm sure I haven't thought of, but among other things, you could make eggs and sperm from people who were dead, or at least from well-preserved cells from people who were dead. That makes, you know, we've had posthumous parenthood, posthumous fatherhood for a while, but this opens some even wilder possibilities.
And we're not talking about cloning dead people, or so that, you know, people hear this going by, they think we're cloning. We're not cloning dead people. We're just
right
taking the cells from them and making another person with two different people.
Right. You're making eggs or sperm from the dead person and combining it with eggs or sperm from someone else, living or dead.
Yeah. You'd
need the cells to be carefully preserved in order or to be very fresh in order for that to happen, though.
Let me give you for example. What about someone like Stephen Hawking? He could have kids. He has kids. But could you then have other kids and screen out, let's say, the ALS genes, sparing the disease? Could you notice that in through your gene screen in the embryos and say, oh, that's not a good one, but this one doesn't have it?
Yeah, so the good news and the bad news of whole genome sequencing is it can tell you everything that genetics can tell us about those embryos. That's the good news. The bad news is there's an awful lot that it can't tell us. Most ALS doesn't seem to have a genetic root. I don't know about Hawking's version of it. I think geneticists understand better than the lay population. Genes aren't as powerful as people often think that they are. This couldn't guarantee you a healthy baby, but it could guarantee you 4,000 to 6,000 diseases that your baby wouldn't have.
Hmm.
So if Hawking's ALS is of genetic origin, and there are some people who have a heavily familial form of ALS, you could screen embryos made from his cells to make sure that those embryos didn't inherit his ALS. Would that change their brilliance or change whatever drove them to be as great as Hawking is? Maybe. Hard to know.
You say that we're talking 20 or 40 years from now, and we would certainly, I would think, know that kind of information. Not how smart you are, but whether there's a genetic connection or not, more closely between the genes and diseases. Let me go to the phone. I'm sorry, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just do. We certainly should know more.
Yeah.
Whether we'll, how much we'll understand about common diseases or diseases that aren't obviously genetic remains to be seen.
Let's go to Aaron in Bethesda. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Just had a quick question. So I assume that technology for gene editing and sort of screening embryos and things of that nature wouldn't be that cheap. And so my concern is that we end up having a genetic class divide, and I was wondering what your guests could say about that, whether or not that would happen, or sort of the realities of that situation.
Good question.
Happy to. I think it's chapter 17 or so. It's, you know, even today, trying to figure out what a medical procedure costs makes you crazy, and trying to predict it 20 to 40 years out is really insane. But I do it in the book anyway. My ballpark guess is roughly $10,000 per baby. I think it's actually likely to be less than that in today's dollars, but somewhere around there. I actually think this will be made available free in countries that have good health systems, because at $10,000 a baby, 100 babies costs the system $1 million. 1 to 2% of babies born naturally are going to have, conceived naturally, are going to have some serious genetic disease. How many of those one or two do you have to burst, how many births of those one or two percent do you have to avoid to save $1 million? About 0.2. I think this is going to be cost effective enough that b- both for egalitarian reasons, but also for sort of hard-nosed financial reasons, it's going to be made available on a subsidized basis to every prospective parent. If I turn out to be wrong about that, I'd still argue strongly it should be made available to everyone. It's not going to make super babies. We don't know how to make super babies. But to add another 10 to 15% better health to the children of the rich but not the children of the poor would be a bad thing, and it's something we need to worry about and try to avoid.
Do you think the FDA would approve something like this, making sperm and eggs from stem cells?
If it's proven safe and effective, I think the FDA would have no choice but to approve it. The FDA isn't a morals police. It's a scientific agency focusing on safety and efficacy. But I think the really interesting thing, Ira, is I think the FDA will approve this not as part of genetic testing, but approve it first as a fertility aid for the millions of people in America who can't have kids because can't have genetic kids because they don't make eggs or sperm. Early illness, an accident, a birth defect, or in the case of many women, just too old, means that there are a lot of people out there who would like to have genetic children who don't make eggs and sperm. This is likely, I think, to be approved first to treat those fertility problems. But in the United States, once the FDA approves a drug or a biological product for one purpose, a doctor is allowed to use it for any other purpose he or she sees fit.
I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Hank Greeley, author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. Really a terrific book, if for nothing else, that it teaches you the ABCs of all the genetics in there right at the beginning. It really makes you think about the future.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I'm really proud of that first section where I try to explain genetics, stem cells, reproduction to lay people. I'm a lay person myself. I'm a lawyer whose last bio class was in 10th grade. I hope people will read that part of the book, too. I hope they'll come to... I came to a love of biology late in my life, and I hope... it's amazing stuff, and I hope other people will be similarly inspired.
Do you think that there are a lot of people... I mean, there are still people around who don't want to know the sex of their children. You know, they don't want to even see ultrasound. Do you think there might be some pushback on this, and even 20 or 40 years from now?
Oh, sure. I don't think everyone will do this, at least if they're in a country that gives them that choice, and that's another worry. I think there'll always be people who, for religious reasons or philosophical reasons or romantic reasons, or just because they're teenagers and getting pregnant in the backseat of the car is what they do, I think there'll always be people who won't use this. I think those numbers will decline as people see that it doesn't produce three-headed monsters and see that avoiding that 1% to 2% chance of having a seriously ill baby has a lot of value. I think that is in the perhaps bad parlance of Silicon Valley. That's the killer app for this.
Mm-hmm.
Avoiding that 1% to 2% chance of having a child who has an early and severe genetic disease will be very attractive to people, I think.
And all those extra embryos, those hundreds of extra embryos, what happens to them?
Presumably they are destroyed, which means I think the Vatican City is not likely to legalize this procedure anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. But they're go ahead.
What that means for more right-to-life states in the United States is an interesting question. We have a very strong right-to-life movement in the U.S., but we also have almost completely unregulated IVF. So I think right-to-life people like healthy babies. They don't necessarily like destroying embryos, but my guess is the U.S. will not ban this kind of technology. Even if it does, if Mississippi does, but Georgia doesn't, I can imagine reproductive tourism being quite common.
Mm-hmm. We've run out of time. I want to thank you, Hank, for writing the book and for coming on Science Friday.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's always great.
Terrific book. The author, Hank Greeley, author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. Hank is a professor of law who teaches law and genetics at Stanford University in California. We're going to take a break, and after the break, we'll share our science fiction picks for summer reading. If you'd like to get on the phone, 844-724-8255, You can also tweet us at SciFry. Your suggestions, your questions for our book club. This time we're going to talk about science fiction books. I know I have a few favorites. Let's see what yours are. We'll be back with our experts after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Summer is finally here, and that's the perfect time to catch up on your reading, of course. Maybe while you're lounging on the beach, while you're waiting in those frustrating TSA lines. If you're still looking for the right book, we are here to help you out. And we're not just talking about any old science books. Today, we're talking science fiction. And my next guests are here to give you all sorts of suggestions to fill your robo-apocalypse and time-traveling fix. And there are a lot of those kinds of books out there. We'll hear about some of them. Annalee Newitz is the tech culture editor at Ars Technica and co-founding editor of io9.com. She's based out of San Francisco. And Vandermeer is a science fiction editor and anthologist and acquiring editor at tor.com. And she's based out of Tallahassee. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. And if our listeners have a summer science fiction pick, we want them to give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry. And we are putting together a list of all the books we're going to talk about today. And in case you missed them, you want to look back upon them, it'll be up on our website at sciencefriday.com/summerbooks. All right, I've pulled a number out of a hat, and Anne, you come up first.
All right.
Have you always been a sci-fi geek?
I think I have.
Yeah?
I think it was born into me. I think it's in my genes. My father is totally a sci-fi geek, and I think that reading science fiction and talking about books with him was a way for us to bond. So it's always been there for me, and I love it.
When was your first book? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh. You know, I can't remember what my first book was. It might have been Jules Verne.
Right.
You know, I had the opportunity to read a lot of my dad's old books, and I think that was probably my first foray into science fiction was Jules Verne, which was just awesome. One of the books that I wanted to talk about, and I think this works perfectly because everyone has those friends that say, oh, but I don't like science fiction. You know, everyone mm-hmm. has that. You have a friend or family member says, oh, I don't like science fiction. Well, the first book that I have on my list, I think it's like the perfect book for someone who doesn't like science fiction. The book I'm talking about is Version Control by Dexter Palmer. It's kind of a time travel book, but it's not really a time travel book. I especially love this book because it gets into the lives of scientists and you get to see a bit of what it's like to work in a lab. Although the story is told from the point of view of Rebecca, who's the wife of the scientist Philip, her insights into her husband's work and the colleagues are very revealing. It's funny because Rebecca is a customer service rep for a dating site called Lovability, and when she meets her husband through this app, even though she tells him that she is not the woman for him, they end up getting married. And it's really kind of a cool story because everything is told from her point of view, and her husband, Philip, is working on his dream project, which is the causality violation machine. He refuses to call it a time travel machine, but that's pretty much what it is.
That's cool. I wrote that down. And Annalee, what's your pick?
So my number one pick for summer is a book called The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. And one of the many reasons why this book is amazing is that unlike a lot of science fiction, which tackles things like physics or advanced computer systems, Jemisin here has chosen to look at Earth science, particularly geoscience on another planet, where the main supercontinent on the planet is breaking in two, which means the planet is incredibly tectonically active. It means that Jemisin's entire plot revolves around understanding plate tectonics and volcanism. And the way that she's dealt with this and made it incredibly fascinating and brought in really excellent characters is to create a world where there's a ruling urban class that has been staving off basically a mass extinction from these incredible volcanoes by essentially enslaving a very mysterious group of people who are called the Origenes. And they seem to be able to control geophysics with their minds. They can stop an earthquake and they can start an earthquake.
Wow.
And it's not quite clear if this is magic or technology. And the novel revolves around a group of these origins and how they're dealing with basically trying to save the world on one hand, but also coping with the fact that they've been put into this position as slaves, in almost slaves. They're supposedly a little bit free, but they're basically slaves to this kind of oppressive regime. And it forces you to ask a lot of questions about not just the cool science stuff, which is great and is incredibly accurate and makes me very happy as someone who loves earth science, but it also really, the characters are incredibly memorable. Their struggles feel very real. And it's a book that's really going to stick with you after you read it.
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask, because, you know, what I loved about The Martian, the book, the movie wasn't as good as the book, was how so much attention was paid to the details and research into the details. Annalee, do you believe that's what part of a great science fiction book is, that they've done a lot of really good research to make it believable?
You know, I think it can work both ways. I think in the case of a book like The Fifth Season, the fact that she clearly has immersed herself in the geosciences helps. But the book would be nothing without the characters and without her kind of imagining this alternate society. So I really think it comes down to something that we call world building, which is, you know, partly it's about thinking about the science, but partly it's about thinking about how all the social structures fit together and how the characters' lives intersect. So I think you have to have the whole world, not just the science, to make it really work.
One of my favorite science fiction books, and I'm getting some tweets in here from Carolyn Cunningham, says Dune is one of her fave sci-fi books. It's one of mine. Also, the Wool series by Hugh Howey. Are you familiar with that? The dystopian. It's just a terrific series of books.
Oh, yes. I'm very familiar with those books. Yeah. I read the first one. And I devoured it so quickly.
Yeah. And then he almost gave them away, I think, literally up on an Amazon or something like that. And then people loved them so much, they asked him to write, you know, more books. And he started writing more. And they're just as good as the first ones. Let's see if our listeners have any ideas. Our number is 844-724-8255 is the number. Let's just start right at the top. Benjamin in Rochester. Hi, Benjamin. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, so my recommendation is actually, it's three books. It's a trilogy. This is going out to the Star Wars fans, of which there are probably at least a few listening. So the trilogy of books is called The Heir to the Empire Trilogy. It's by an author named Timothy Zahn. And they were written in the early 1990s. They're sequels to the original Star Wars trilogy. It's about 5 years after Return of the Jedi ends. They're kind of nice because you don't need to know really all that much about Star Wars. You don't need to know really anything besides the original movies to kind of get into them. They were written sort of to be like a sequel trilogy. And in fact, a number of things that were sort of pulled into, I guess, what we now know as sort of the new movies that are coming out, like Force Awakens, some of the things in those, like characters who are children of the previous characters, even some of the names of planets in the Star Wars series, like Coruscant from the prequels, that all came out of these three books.
Wow.
And they're really great.
Okay, we're running short on getting all these books in. So, okay, that's a great selection, because we literally, thanks for calling, Benjamin, we literally have three or four calls online suggesting Star Wars type books. So, still popular, Anne and Annalee.
Yes.
It's true. You can't get away from space opera.
And give me your next pick.
I just want to jump into international science fiction, if I might. The next book on my list is Core of the Sun by Finnish writer Johanna Sinisalo. I absolutely love this book. In some ways, it reminds me a little bit of her novel, her critically acclaimed novel, Troll, because of the way that she tells this particular story. She's presenting an alternate version of present-day Finland by using experimental storytelling. She has letters, dictionary entries, short fiction from popular magazines in this world, essay tests, government decrees, and then she also has the straight-ahead narrative. And you had mentioned, Ira, earlier about science and the research, and does that make it better? Well, the thing that's so great about this particular book is that Johanna uses real science and real history, and she weaves it in through this fake alternate Finland that she creates. And what we've got here is when Finland gains its independence from Russia in the early 20th century, the newly created government is called a justistocracy, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Mm-hmm. They are promoting the health and well-being of its citizens, but they're pursuing this using genetic engineering and selective breeding of humans. So they're creating these this subgenre race of humans that are called the Eloi and the Morlocks. And if those names sound familiar, it's because it's a nod to H.G. Wells' Time Machine. But basically, it's genetic engineering to make perfect breeding machines of the women. And the main character is one of those Eloi, one of those breeding machines, except she's not going along with the program. And throughout that book, with all of the different things going on in that world, in addition, there's this underground drug scene. But it's not the drugs that you would think about. You know, you think about these mind-altering drugs. The drugs that are prohibited in Finland at that time are hot chili peppers. And to me, that makes this the perfect summer read, because when you think about Finland, you think about it being cold all the time, and yet the drug of choice that is being stamped down by their government is hot chili peppers, and the hotter the better.
Wow. We are phone lines are full of book suggestions. We have people tweeting in. Let's see what some of the tweets. N.K. Jameson's fifth season. Ready Player One is another suggestion. Lock In. Also, Kim Stanley, or anything Kim Stanley Robinson writes is a suggestion. Annalie, your next pick, please.
So I'm going to bring together dystopia and space opera just to make everyone excited. a book that just came out last week, Nine Fox Gambit by Yoon Ha Lee. This is a great book, and it's really been long awaited by fans of Lee's work. He's published a number of short stories, and everyone's been really waiting for a novel. And this is military science fiction, but it's incredibly philosophical at the same time. So there's a lot of action, and it's set in a far future where this large volume of space is ruled by a group called the Hexarchy, and they control their people through controlling the calendar, which I think is a really interesting metaphor for how ideology works, because it allows you to think about how time itself can be distorted by belief systems. And so when groups break off from the Hexarchy, they become heretical groups, and they create their own kinds of calendars. And so it's this kind of battle over how we're going to understand time. And the main character is a great military leader from the Hexarchy, and she's been sent to deal with one of these heretical groups. And in order to help her, they've injected the mind of a kind of psychopathic military strategist. So she's literally of two minds about what she's doing. She's got this strategist in her head who's kind of there through digital technology, and she's got her own mind, and she's trying to deal with this division within her culture, this splinter group that's broken off. And it's a really, you know, the action is white hot. It's really a fun strategy tale. But it's also, it really is quite thought-provoking and philosophical about what does it mean to believe in something? What happens when you're part of an authoritarian regime and you're trying to figure out, wait, is this the right thing to do? Is it authoritarian? Are we, you know, what are we doing here? And so it's just, I would recommend it, especially for people who want to escape but also want to be left with a lot of really interesting thoughts in their head.
Interesting thoughts, indeed. This hour, in case you're just joining us, we're talking about book reading this summer, science fiction books on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Annalie Newitz and Anne Vandermeer. Let's go to the phones. I thought I had him right there. Let's go to, who do we have? Oh, let's go to Bill in Fresno. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Good. So my two recommendations, well, you already mentioned one of them via tweet, was Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. I really enjoyed it. It's just kind of very summer light reading. Doesn't make you think too much, but it's just a fun book about kind of how basically it's like World of Warcraft became all-consuming and everyone just played it all the time kind of thing. There's a lot more to it, but I really enjoyed that. Just a fun read. And then a little bit more of a serious sci-fi book was I've read a couple times and a couple years ago was Forever War by Joe Haldeman, kind of on like a darker, more realistic sci-fi with like kind of like Robert Heinlein's stuff. And I just enjoyed it because it took the initial premise of like interstellar war, and then it, and then the rest of the physics, specifically like the you can't like light travel away, was really interesting in the sense of you can't. There was always a technology gap, one way or the other, between us and the enemy.
Right.
And I enjoyed that book a lot. It's just a new take on a kind of a standard sci-fi battle type of thing.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Quick time for I think we have time for one more suggestion from both of my guests here. Anne Vandermeer, what's your next topic?
Well, I'm going to jump in and do something completely different. I'm going to recommend also Stories of Your Life and Others, which is a short story collection by Ted Chiang. And there's a lot of reasons why I've selected this. I've always been a longtime fan of Ted Chiang, and most of his stories are of a longer length. They're novella or novelette. And I believe that that is actually the perfect length to tell a science fiction story. I mean, I know, yes, there's a lot of shorter ones, and there's great novels, but I just feel like that's the perfect length. And I also love his work because many of the scientists in his stories are women, and it's just matter of fact. It's not remarked upon. It just is, and that's what makes it even better. His precise use of language in all of his fiction and the title story is no exception, A Story of Your Life. It's indeed language is the primary focus for Dr. Banks, who's his main character. She's given the task of communicating with this new alien race they've just discovered called the Heptapods. Their spoken language is vastly different from their written language, and the written language affects time and the outcome events. The beauty of this story is how Chiang interweaves memories of the linguist's daughter back and forth through time as Dr. Banks continues to unravel the secrets to communicating with these aliens.
I'm going to have to stop you there. I'm going to have to stop you there because we've run out of time, and you're spinning spinning a good yarn, but we'll have to read the rest in the book.
Yes, read that book. It just came out.
What's the name again?
It's called Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang.
All right. And we actually have a list of all the books we've talked about today on our website at sciencefriday.com/summerbooks. I want to thank you both. Annalee Newitz is the tech culture editor at Ars Technica and founding editor of io9.com. She's based in San Francisco. And Vandermeer, science fiction editor and anthologist and acquiring editor at tour.com. Based in Tallahassee, Florida. Thank you both for taking time to be with us
today. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. This was great. I love to talk about books.
We'll have you back. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great week and happy Father's Day. Happy Father's Day to everybody out there. Give them a phone call, huh? We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.